My name is Blaine Carlton, and I would like to welcome you to the session entitled The Dialogue Toward Forgiveness, a Documentary History of the Intellectual Community and Church Leadership. I'm to remind you that entrance is by name tag only or by ticket. The main presentation will be given by Levina Fielding Anderson. Levina Fielding Anderson received her BA and MA degrees at Brigham Young in English, and also her PhD at the University of Washington. She is currently the president of Editing Inc., an editing company, and she's the production manager of the Review of Higher Education, and she currently serves as the editor for the Journal of Mormon History. She has also been a teaching assistant at BYU and the University of Washington. She's been on the editorial staff of the Ensign magazine. She's been an associate editor and co-associate editor of Dialogue and an editor of the Journal of Mormon History, as I indicated. She is or has also been a member of a number of professional organizations, including Phi Kappa Phi, the Association of Utah Publishers, Mormon History Association, Association of Mormon Letters, and the Western American Literature. She has fulfilled a number of, served in the church in a number of different capacities. She's including the fulfillment of a mission to France and Switzerland. She has also held numerous positions, including primary teacher, gospel doctrine teacher, Relief Society teacher, General Relief Society Writing Committee, piano organist, and Tiger Club leader. Her editing publications include Sisters in Spirit, Mormon Women in Historical and Cultural Perspective, and My Father, David O. McKay. After Levina gives her... Oh, and the most important thing, she is married to Paul Lawrence Anderson, a history architect and museum designer, and they have one child. I don't know if that's most important, but at least that's a very important thing. Okay, after Levina speaks, Richard Pohl, who will give his comments. Richard Pohl is a professor emeritus. Excuse me? Richard Pohl. Okay. Richard Pohl is professor emeritus of history at Western Illinois University. He's a native of Salt Lake City. He received his bachelor's of arts at and MA degrees at Texas Christian University and a PhD in history at the University of California, Berkeley. He taught history at BYU for 22 years before going to Western Illinois University in 1970 as vice president for administration. He was a charter member of the Mormon History Association and was its president from 1969 through 1970. He's the writer of many articles and was also the general editor of Utah's History, and co-author with Eugene Campbell of the book entitled Hubie Brown, His Life and Thought, and author of History and Faith, Reflections of a Mormon Historian. He has conducted travel study tours for BYU, and he retired in 1983 and currently lives with his wife in Provo, Jean or Imogene. They have three children and seven grandchildren, the oldest of whom earned an A at in the American University class that Professor Pohl taught last fall at BYU. I'm not sure if she deserved it, but anyway. Levina will have roughly 50 minutes to give her presentation, after which Professor Pohl will, or Richard will give his comments, which should take about 22 minutes. Afterwards, we'll have a question and answer period.
Oh, Paul said I shouldn't begin with a joke because it will be quoted out of context, but I can't resist. I think that the real title for this paper should come from a statement by Paul Edwards describing what he calls the sumo wrestling style of leadership, which consists of throwing your weight around while trying to cover your rear. Now, I didn't say that. Paul Edwards said it. This presentation is a chronology of events that I consider significant in establishing the record of the frequently tense relationship during the past 15 years or so between the institutional church and two overlapping sub-communities, intellectuals and women. I believe there is no question that the institutional church sees these two constituencies as troublesome, but I would characterize members of both as friendly critics. They occupy a sometimes uneasy middle ground between the unfriendly critics of Mormonism on the one hand and the uncritical friendlies within the church on the other, who proclaim, "My church, right or wrong, but it's never wrong." I believe this topic is important enough that I am, with co-author Gary James Bergera, beginning a book on the intellectual history of Mormonism. I hope that you will share your own concerns, perceptions, experiences, and insights with Gary and me, and I thank the person who just handed me a note as this session began. The differences have been negotiated between scholars, feminists, and ecclesiastical leaders in various ways, sometimes mutually respectful, sometimes harsh and punitive. This is a chronology, not yet an analysis. One reason is that the sheer facts of what happened need to be determined before a responsible analysis can be made. For another reason, I approach this topic as a woman interested in relationships. I am less interested in the various positions defended and attacked about, say, the New Mormon history, than I am about what such attacks and defenses do to our community and the human costs in pain, mistrust, and violations of agency. The relationship between Mormon intellectuals and feminists and their church is a troubled and painful relationship, and I hope to see steps taken toward reconciliation. So why am I committing a potentially disruptive act? I am doing it because I feel I must. I spent the fall and the winter making this decision, and it was triggered directly by the First Presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve Statement on Symposia last August. I carefully reread the Book of Mormon, paying particular attention to passages about pride, rebelliousness, and disobedience. I prayed, fasted, and went to the temple. I performed my callings with new exactness and was newly attentive in meetings. I started taking notes in sacrament meeting. I was looking for reasons not to write this paper. Earlier, I had prayed to know my responsibility in the Vietnam War, about priesthood for blacks, about the IWI conference, and the Equal Rights Amendment. In each case, I received a clear answer: this is not your cause. This winter, on this issue, I received a different answer. I say this not to play spiritual giant games, but to tell you that I am trying to be as responsible as I know how to be. I stand before you as a witness in the household of faith. I am not an accuser. I am not a judge. I know that the record is incomplete. I know that there are parts I do not understand. I know that many of the victims of ecclesiastical harassment have not been totally innocent of provocative actions. Furthermore, I know that my record is lopsided. Since I have gathered these reports from the members, not from the ecclesiastical leaders, they inevitably reflect the perspectives of members. Nor am I free from personal sympathy in reporting them. There is no way at this stage to make allowance for the fact that a bishop or a general authority would probably tell his version of the story a different way, that the members' shock and hurt inevitably overlay memories of the experience, or that the member may minimize in retelling or may still genuinely be unaware of the extent to which his or her behavior may have been interpreted or misinterpreted as provocative, defiant, or deviant. I do not speculate on the motives of members involved in the cases reported here. Some of these motives may have been unworthy. But I do not speculate on the motives of their ecclesiastical leaders either, and some of those motives may also have been unworthy. Despite the lopsidedness, I insist that such a record is worth creating and maintaining. It is driven by the search for knowledge. We must not deny that such things exist, nor that they are wrong. Once we know what happened, then we can begin to understand it. With understanding comes forgiveness. And with forgiveness, then love can increase in our community. I want a more loving community, a more inclusive community, a more forgiving community. For example, the disclosure that Elder Paul Dunn had fabricated some of his military and baseball stories and his explanation that they were just parables made me physically nauseated. But when I read Elder Dunn's apology in the church news soon after the full, helpful, and balanced discussion of the issue in Sunstone, I forgave him with all my heart, willingly and fully. Thanks to both Sunstone and Elder Dunn, I feel that a breach in the community has been healed. Certainly, one in my heart has been. I offer this paper as another step in the ongoing dialogue within our community, with the hope of forgiveness, with the offer of forgiveness. 1965. At a gathering of Mormon historians in San Francisco, the Mormon History Association was born. 1966. Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought, began publication. 1969, BYU Studies, established in 1959, was revitalized and began including special issues on history. January 1971, The Ensign began publication. The Relief Society magazine, among others, stopped. September 1971, all LDS women automatically became members of the Relief Society. Dues were abolished, and they were forbidden to have separate fundraising activities or budgets. 14th January 1972, Leonard J. Arrington became director of the Church History Division and was called to be church historian. He was sustained in that position by a show of hands on April 6th at General Conference. July 1973, I began working for the Ensign. 1974, the Journal of Mormon History and Exponent 2 began publication. Winter 1975, Sunstone began publication. 1976, Story of the Latter-day Saints by James B. Allen and Glenn Leonard was published. It sold out within a few months but was not reprinted because some general authorities were offended at its approach. Ezra Taft Benson, defending national heroes that summer, denounced historians who inordinately humanize the prophets of God so that their human frailties become more evident than their spiritual qualities. January 1977, the first annual symposium of the Association for Mormon Letters, still a thriving organization, was held. June 1977, at the Utah State meeting of the International Women's Year, almost 14,000 women crammed the Salt Palace, many of them responding to an invitation from the Relief Society to send 10 women per ward, and many of them in response to private assignments from ecclesiastical leaders. Vigorously, they voted down such resolutions as equal pay for equal work. Spring 1978, portraits of the church historians were hung. Leonard Arrington's was not among them. It was later, years later, hung in a separate grouping of division heads. 8th June 1978, the First Presidency approved a statement released on 9th June that the Lord, by revelation, has confirmed that the long-promised day has come when every faithful, worthy man in the church may receive the holy priesthood. President Kimball, responding to an Associated Press query about the ordination of women, stated, "We don't expect any revelation regarding women and the priesthood." August 1978. This may be 1979. The first Sunstone Theological Symposium was held in Salt Lake City. 28 September 1978, the First Presidency reversed the prohibition dating from December 1967 that forbade women to pray in sacrament meeting. October 1978, Relief Society President Barbara B. Smith presented the Relief Society's Wheat and the Wheat Fund to President Kimball. The first women's general fireside was broadcast from the Salt Lake Tabernacle on 16th September 1978. 4th March 1979, Ezra Taft Benson, president of the Quorum of the Twelve, told the men in a 14-stake fireside at BYU, "You are the provider, and it takes the edge off your manliness when you have the mother of your children also be a provider." August 1979, Ann Elton Tanner, first counselor in the First Presidency, stated, "When the prophet speaks, the debate is over." 19th August 1979, Ann Kenney, a student at the University of Utah, was set apart as president of the University of Utah Second Stake Sunday School with the approval of an apostle. A month later, she was released after a different decision by Ezra Taft Benson. 1st December 1979, Sonia Johnson, known nationally as a Mormon equal rights activist, was tried and excommunicated in a bishop's court. During the previous year, the Church Public Communications Department, while claiming that Mormons against the ERA were acting independently as concerned citizens, had organized covert activities including the following. Some wards in Virginia distributed brochures and petitions in their lobbies linking Phyllis Schlafly's Eagle Forum with the LDS Virginia Citizens Coalition. The newsletter of the McLean Virginia Stake announced that the President Spencer W. Kimball had enlisted the membership to fight the ERA. Funds raised by Virginia bishops were laundered by a pseudo-account called FACT, standing for Families Are Concerned Today. Ward houses and church meetings were used in Florida to lobby legislators. Church Boy Scout troops passed out anti-ERA literature to ward members in Arizona. Anti-ERA leaders were set apart in Missouri, where Relief Society sisters were bussed, wearing dresses and carrying sack lunches as instructed, from stake senders to the state legislature. President Hinckley denied the busing on NBC's Today Show. As a consequence, the aftermath included excommunications, disfellowshipments, releases from church jobs, revoked temple recommends, voiced fears, hurt, and despair of scores, if not hundreds, of women, one of whom took her own life. As another consequence, a group of Mormon women with historical and feminist interests who had been regularly meeting for lunch at the Lion House or in a dining room off the church cafeteria since 1974 began seriously planning a book of historical and theological essays on Mormon women. This book, which I co-edited with Maureen Ersenbach Beecher, was Sisters in Spirit, published by the University of Illinois Press in 1987. Contributors are Jolene Edmonds Rockwood, Melody Munch Charles, Linda P. Wilcox, Marianne McMurray, Carol Cornwall Madsen, Linda King Newell, Jill Mulvey Durr, Mary Beth Raines, and Greta Baloff Peterson. 25th January, 1982. The First Presidency wrote Leonard J. Arrington a letter extending him an honorable release, both as church historian and as director of the History Division. Elder Durham was set apart as church historian privately on Tuesday, 8th February, 1982. 1st July, 1980. It was announced that the History Division, renamed the Joseph Fielding Smith Institute for Church History, would move to Brigham Young University. By February of 1981, a 16-volume history of the church was canceled and the authors were paid for the proportion of the work they had done. 19th February, 1981, Elder Bruce R. McConkie wrote to Gene England, rebuking him for his views on the perfection and progression of God, ordering him to stop speaking or publishing on the topic and announcing, "It is my province to teach to the church what the doctrine is. It is your province to echo what I say or remain silent." March 1981, Mark Hoffman offered his forged Joseph Smith III blessing first to the LDS Church, then to the RLDS Church, then sold it to the LDS Church. April 1981, Signature Books was organized. 25th June 1981, at about 9:30 a.m., the managing editor of the Ensign, J.M. Todd, ushered me upstairs to the office of Verrill Scott, where I was informed that I was being summarily terminated. If you'll pardon me, I want to go into more detail on this particular episode than the others. I'd never talked in public about being fired until I told this story at the Washington, D.C. Symposium in April. My reticence is not because it was particularly traumatic, but because it wasn't. And I'm therefore a little abashed to put myself on the same list with people like Stan Larson, who was forced to resign, or Linda Newell and Val Avery, whose children were deeply and painfully impacted by the ban on their prize-winning biography of Emma Smith, or Michael Quinn, whose teaching career was shattered by his prize-winning and thoroughly documented histories. But it is a relevant story to Sunstone. Elder Hartman Rector delivered a conference talk in April, this is 1981, containing a list of the sins of the last days that had to be toned down for publication. Peggy Fletcher, then publisher at Sunstone, called me after the Ensign had appeared and said they were going to run a parallel before and after version. She was going to transcribe the videotape, and I said, "Oh, don't bother. All the old conference talks are sitting out here waiting to be thrown away. I'll just send you the earliest copy." I walked out to the conference work area, pulled out the bottom copy of the rector talk, photocopied it, put it in an interoffice envelope, addressed it to a member of the Sunstone staff who was a church employee in another department, and dropped it into the interoffice mail. The envelope and the manuscript were lying on Verrill Scott's desk when we entered his office the next morning. Jay later told me that he had seen the envelope in the outgoing mail and had felt inspired to open it. The meeting was brief. Jay told me I was being summarily terminated, that Elder Ballard concurred in the decision. He was then advisor to the magazines. And that the grounds were distributing confidential material to unauthorized personnel. While I fully understood that conference talks were confidential before they were delivered, I asked for clarification about how a conference talk could be confidential after it was delivered. Verl Scott assured me that a manuscript of what the ensign had actually printed would still be considered confidential. Jay and an individual representing the personnel department escorted me to my office, supervised the packing of my personal effects, and took me to my car. The whole process was over with by noon. At one point, Jay informed me of the fascinating fact that the earliest version of the rector talk had actually contained additional material that Elder Rector did not actually deliver. And I left with one regret, that I hadn't bothered to read the version I photocopied for Peggy. So to this day, I don't know what the original version contained. I expected to feel traumatized by being fired. To my surprise, I didn't. I felt quite cheerful. I received dozens of calls from friends who were angry, sympathetic, grieved, and hurt. I appreciated their concern, but we usually ended up laughing together. Judy Dushku offered to organize a legal aid fund so I could sue. I told her I didn't want my job back. Mary Beth Rain said, "You'll probably crash in a couple of days. Call me day or night if you need to talk." I never did. Linda Silito sent me a poem that instead captured my feelings precisely. "One by one, they throw us from the tower, and we spread our wings and fly." From that day to this, I have never experienced a moment of regret for the almost 8 years I spent at the Ensign, nor one moment of regret that I am not still there. Although I sometimes disagreed with Jay's management style and felt considerable frustration periodically at the correlation review system, I have only the best of feelings for him. I went on to other things without a backward glance. My freelance editing business promptly expanded to full-time, and my first job was drafting an autobiography of Leonard Arrington from his personal papers. I hope someday it will be published. 22nd August, 1981. Elder Boyd K. Packer, speaking to church education system personnel, announced that the mantle is far, far greater than the intellect, warned that Mormon history might be giving equal time to the adversary, and urged taking a selective approach to history. 18th November 1981, the Seventh East Press published Michael Quinn's response to Elder Packer, a story by Kenneth Woodward in Newsweek, February 15, 1982, pointed out that Quinn had violated the Mormon taboo that proscribes the faithful from publicly criticizing the Lord's anointed by name. Elder Packer's address, originally scheduled to appear in the February issue of the Ensign, was withdrawn, but was published in BYU Study several months later. 30th September 1981, Lewis C. Midgley of BYU's Political Science Department attacked the New Mormon History and Historians for a lack of faith. Joined periodically by David Earl Bone and Gary Novak, he has continued his vigorous assault on objective history to the present. 23rd February 1982, Don Schmidt announced to the archive search room staff that nobody would see papers of any former apostles until further notice. The policy on access has continued to bob and weave over the past 10 years. 25th February 1982, Mary Bradford set the schedule with Jack and Linda Newell, the new co-editors, to move Dialogue to Salt Lake City. I became associate editor for the next 5 years. 28th February 1982, at a meeting of the B.H. Roberts Society, James Clayton of the University of Utah denounced the closing of the archives and challenged Elder Packer's position as intellectually and morally irresponsible from the historian's point of view. May 1982, Michael Quinn's stake presidency informed him that five former bishops had recommended him as the new bishop for his ward, but that Apostle Markey Peterson had blocked the appointment. 25th through 27th May 1982, approximately 56 women from across the nation met in Nauvoo for a retreat we call Pilgrimage, organized by Maureen Ursenbach Beecher, Jill Mulvey-Durr, Carol Cornwall Madsen, Linda King Newell, and me. We discussed the Relief Society, change, the institutional church, and our spiritual lives. The energy generated from that gathering was so great that we left resolved to conduct regional gatherings of the same sort. The Salt Lake Pilgrimage, an invitational gathering, held its 10th meeting in May of this year. The Midwest Pilgrims, an open group, now meets twice a year. The annual Exponent 2 retreat in New Hampshire has a spin-off Provo Canyon retreat organized by Provo women that has been meeting for about 5 years. 11th February, 1983. The Seventh East Press, an unofficial newspaper, was banned from BYU campus after publishing an interview with Sterling McMurrin in January. The newspaper ceased publication on 12th April. In April, Brent Metcalf was first fired, then at his bishop's insistence, allowed to resign as a security guard at the church office building for his research into the New York period of Mormonism. 15th May, 1983, Elder Packer, speaking at a special priesthood conference, prefaced his remarks with a denunciation of intellectuals who think they are serving scholarship but who are dragging sacred things into the mud and then think they can remove their muddy boots and enter the temple. He was apparently responding to an early draft of David John Berger's article, The Fullness of the Priesthood, The Second Anointing, and Latter-day Saint Theology and Practice, a much-revised version of which would be published within the week by Dialogue. Sunday, 22nd May, 1983, Dawn Tracy published an article in the Provo Daily Herald reporting that she had talked to 14, the number differs in various accounts, Mormon writers in four states who said they had been questioned by their local bishops or state presidents and told the church was worried about their faithfulness. All had contributed to Dialogue, Sunstone, or the Seventh East Press. Roy Doxey, former BYU Dean of Religious Education, said that Apostle Marky Peterson had ordered the investigations. Three were faculty members at BYU. Richard Craycroft, Dean of BYU's College of Humanities and a stake president, commented, "If this is what the brethren want, then good LDS must say it is appropriate." Jack Newell, co-editor of Dialogue, commented, "We are gravely concerned that the faith of any Latter-day Saint would be questioned, including the basis of his or her commitment to legitimate scholarship and the free exchange of ideas." Scott Fallring, stake president, chastised him for his writings but admitted he had not read the offending articles. The stake president of Gary Bergera conceded that it was clear that Gary did not support Gerald and Sandra Tanner, about whom he had published an article in Seventh East Press, quote, "but because I interviewed them, I came close to supporting them." Other writers questioned were Armin Moss, Tom Alexander, David Berger, Lester Bush, Ed Ashmont, Jeff Keller, and Richard Sherlock. When Peggy Fletcher learned that her bishop had also received a call, she went to a high church official to complain, and you heard Peggy tell the story last night. It was later learned on good authority, she said, that the Council of the Twelve was asked to lay off, and indeed the calls abruptly ended. October 1984, Elder Ronald E. Pullman, speaking in conference on the Gospel and the Church, saw his address appear in a much-edited Ensign version and also became the first general authority to retape his talk, complete with a cough track to make it sound as if an audience were present. April 1985, the issue of Dialogue containing Michael Quinn's 100-page article, LDS Church Authority and New Plural Marriages 1890 to 1904, appeared. It definitively identified a significant number of general authorities as marrying, performing marriages, and authorizing the marriages of others in polygamy after the Manifesto of 1890. Elder James M. Paramore, acting on instructions from three unnamed apostles, ordered Michael, stake president, to confiscate his temple recommend in May 1985. He further instructed the stake president to tell Michael that this action was a local decision. The stake president agreed to hold the interview but refused to lie about the source of the instructions. 12th April 1985, Stephen F. Christensen, who had purchased the Salamander letter in January 1984 from Mark Hoffman and Lynn Jacobs, donated it to the church. After Hoffman leaked copies and a session of MHA was devoted to it, the text was published in the church news. 17th May 1985, the first Sunstone Symposium in Washington, D.C. convened. 9th June 1985, Bishop Ricks in Utah, Idaho, and Arizona received telephoned instructions from church headquarters not to invite Linda Newell or Valene Avery, co-authors of the Emma Smith biography, to speak on historical topics in church meetings. Neither Linda nor Val was officially informed of this decision. At their own request, Linda and Jack met with elders Neil A. Maxwell and Alan H. Oakes, who told Linda that some aspects of the portrayal of Joseph Smith were the problem area. This book won the Best Book Award from the Mormon History Association and the John Whitmer Historical Association. It co-won the prestigious $10,000 Evans Biography Award, sharing the honor with Richard L. Bushman. The ban, which lasted for 10 months, immediately tripled sales. 23rd, June 1985, President Hinckley at a young adult fireside broadcast from Temple Square stated, "I plead with you, do not let yourselves be numbered among the critics, among the dissidents, among the apostates. That does not mean that you cannot read widely. Fundamental to our theology is belief in individual freedom of inquiry, thought, and expression. Constructive discussion is a privilege of every Latter-day Saint." 16th, August 1985. 2 months later, Elder Dallin H. Oaks, speaking at BYU's Sperry Symposium on the Doctrine and Covenants, warned members of the church not to criticize or depreciate a person for the performance of an office to which he or she has been called of God. It does not matter that the criticism is true. 27th August 1985, Elder Russell Nelson, speaking at Brigham Young University, remarked, "We now live in a season in which some self-serving historians grovel for truth that would defame the dead and the defenseless. Extortion by threat of disclosing truth is labeled blackmail, is sordid disclosure for personal attention or financial gain, not closely related." 18th September 1985, Stan Larson, a scripture translation researcher in the translation division, was suspended, then given a choice of resigning or being fired after his boss got a copy of Larson's paper comparing the Book of Mormon version of the Sermon on the Mount with the oldest known manuscript. It identified errors in the Book of Mormon which did not appear before the 1769 edition of the King James edition. 28 September 1985, Keith Perkins, chairman of the BYU Department of Church History and Doctrine, was quoted as saying that officials have established their own symposiums because MHA wasn't allowing Orthodox views to be presented. Employees may attend MHA meetings, but BYU no longer pays travel costs. Two CES employees said supervisors have questioned them about papers they've published. 15 October 1985, Stephen Christensen and Kathy Sheets were killed by homemade bombs. Mark Hoffman, their creator, was injured the next day by a third bomb, but lived to avoid trial through a successful plea bargain. Hoffman remained a member of the church during this process and was not excommunicated until 6 months after he pleaded guilty to killing two people. 2nd April 1986, BYU's accreditation self-study noted that BYU administrators are advised not to publish in Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought, nor to participate in the Sunstone Symposia. 4th May 1986, Elder Oaks, speaking at the LDSSA fireside in the Salt Lake Tabernacle, again ordered members of the church not to criticize leaders, even if the criticism is true, then added, "This is not for the benefit of the leaders. It is to safeguard the spiritual well-being of members who are prone to murmur and find fault." 27th May 1986, the Church Historical Department instituted tightened security measures and required prospective researchers to sign an agreement to submit their pre-publication manuscripts to the Copyrights and Permissions Office. Summer 1986, BYU students began publishing the Student Review, an off-campus newspaper which still appears regularly. 27th February 1987, President Ezra Taft Benson, speaking at a parent's fireside, stated, "Contrary to conventional wisdom, a mother's calling is in the home, not in the marketplace." Early 1987, D. Michael Quinn's exhaustively documented Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview was published by Signature Books. Since the fall of 1986, Quinn, who had continuing status, was a full professor of history, had been voted outstanding professor by graduating history majors, and was director of the History Department's graduate program, was denied travel and research funds even to represent BYU at conferences on non-Mormon topics. Some colleagues circulated rumors that he had been excommunicated and made disparaging personal remarks. On 20th January 1988, he sent the administration a letter of resignation, effective at the end of spring semester. Thereafter, he lived in California and Louisiana, moving back to Salt Lake City last Sunday. 3rd May 1988, David P. Wright, BYU assistant professor in Asian and Near Eastern languages, was informed that his contract would not be renewed because of his unorthodox views on biblical scholarship, scriptural prophecy, and the Book of Mormon. The letter acknowledged that he did not teach these views in the classroom. August 1988, the Mormon Women's Forum held its first meeting in Salt Lake City. It now has several additional chapters. 2nd October 1988, Michaeline P. Grassley, General President of the Primary, became the first woman who was not being called to or released from the presidency of an auxiliary to speak in a regular session of General Conference, apparently since Lucy Mack Smith in 1845. 9th March, 1989, Edwin B. Firmage, a grandson of Hubie Brown and a professor of constitutional law at the University of Utah, stated, "I long for that time when four black people, three of them women, will sit on the stand as general authorities." He reported receiving death threats after making this speech. 1st April, 1989, Elder Dallin Oaks warned church members against listening to alternate voices, noting that some are the lost leading the lost, while others are of those whose avowed or secret object is to deceive and devour the flock. 1st September, 1989, Elder George P. Lee of the First Quorum of the 70 was excommunicated for apostasy and conduct unbecoming a member. January 1990, Carolyn Pearson's one-woman show, Mother Wove the Morning, extended a 14-day engagement to 30 performances. She has played it on the road or in standing weekend engagements near her home in California ever since. The number of performances is now in the hundreds. The audiences number in the hundreds of thousands. 10th April, 1990, changes in the temple ceremony that eliminated symbolic violence and somewhat broadened the role for women triggered articles by the Associated Press stories, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, Time Magazine, U.S. News and World Report, and many local papers. Mormons who were quoted included me, Rebecca England, Ross Peterson, then co-editor of Dialogue, Alan Roberts, Ron Prittis, Robert Reese, Keith Norman, and various public relations officers, all of whom made comments ranging from favorable to complimentary. Acting on instructions reportedly from President Hinckley, the area presidents of the quoted Mormons had their stake presidents interview them. Mine was a cordial meeting. However, Ross Peterson's stake president took away his temple recommend. In a follow-up meeting, his area presidency, Elders William Bradford, Malcolm Jepson, and Richard P. Lindsay, threatened further action and referred to a thick file dating back to the 1960s on Ross. It was only after a flood of letters and phone calls to church headquarters plus individual lobbying of general authorities by Ross's friends that his recommend was restored in June. Keith Norman had presented a paper at the 1990 Sunstone Symposium in Washington, D.C. a week before the changes, suggesting that the temple penalties had outgrown their usefulness. His bishop reluctantly told him that he had been instructed to deny Keith a temple recommend for 1 year, after which he could have a recommend if he repented. When Keith asked of what he needed to repent, his bishop replied, "I don't know." As of this summer, Keith still does not have a temple recommend, even though he remains fully active. 4th November, 1990, Sunstone's June issue came out about mid-October, a little slippage there, containing a summary of news stories about the temple changes. Albert Peck, stake president, informed him that Sunstone's coverage was inappropriate and confiscated to Albert's temple recommend. Daniel Rector, then publisher, had his temple recommend revoked at the same time. His has since been restored. Albert's has not. 16th February, 1991, the Arizona Republic published a long article based on Lynn Packer's research documenting that Elder Paul H. Dunn, who had been given emeritus status in September of 1989 for age and health reasons, had fabricated some of his most popular and most profitable war and baseball stories. Packer's contract at BYU was not renewed. Elder Dunn first justified his fabrications as parables, but about 2 weeks after Sunstone's thorough coverage, he published a letter in the church news, "I feel a deep sense of remorse and ask forgiveness of any whom I may have offended." April 1991, a student prayed to Our Mother and Father in Heaven at BYU commencement. 5th April 1991, President Hinckley warned regional representatives to be alert to small beginnings of apostasy and cited prayers to Mother in Heaven as an example. 23rd August 1991, 2 weeks after the Sunstone Symposium in Salt Lake City, the Council of the First Presidency and the Quorum of the 12 Apostles issued a statement expressing concern about recent symposia that result in ridiculing sacred things or injuring the church, detracting from its mission, or jeopardizing the well-being of its members. Two Salt Lake men who protested were relieved of their church callings, and three general authorities alluded warningly to the statement in October General Conference. September 1991, the Mormon Women's Forum featured a panel on Mother in Heaven that included Carolyn Pearson, Rodney Turner, and Paul Toscano. The this panel is reported in the current edition of the newsletter, which is available at this symposium. President Hinckley repeated the Mother in Heaven section of his address at the Women's General Fireside in late September, a meeting transmitted by satellite to Mormon chapels around the world. 14 September 1991, the Salt Lake Tribune reported that David Knowlton had been called in by his stake president less than a week after his presentation in Sunstone about why leftist terrorists in Latin America target the church. He called the meeting intimidation and protested in writing to his academic officers with copies to President Benson. Rex Lee, president of BYU, commented, "This is just not a BYU matter." September 1991, Elder Neil A. Maxwell, speaking at the Farm's annual banquet, told his listeners, "You serve as mentors and models for the rising generation of Latter-day Saints scholars and students. Let them learn submissiveness from the eloquence of your example." About the 22nd of September 1991, the long-awaited Encyclopedia of Mormonism appeared. Such periodicals as Dialogue, Sunstone, and Exponent 2, though separately indexed, are discussed only in an article entitled Societies and Organizations. 17th October 1991, at a B.H. Roberts Society meeting, David Knowlton said, "We intellectuals should stop looking over our shoulders to see if the brethren are going to disagree with us, call us to repentance, hassle us, limit our access to information, or challenge us. In many ways, that is their job, although it is indeed ours to critique all those actions." Michael Quinn, presenting in the same meeting, explained that general authorities typically attack the messenger, and attacks are harsher when the messenger is an active member. Between October 1991 and July 1992, in the aftermath of the August Symposium statement, Brent Metcalf's bishop asked if he had ever considered having his name removed from the records of the church. Other people were also interviewed. In one case, a bishop began an investigation of an individual, A., initially representing himself as acting on his own authority, but later confirming that the stake president had requested the investigation. The bishop informed A, in writing, that he was referring the case to the stake president and that, after a full investigation, excommunication might be a possibility. A wrote to the stake president in January expressing willingness to discuss matters, but stating that he felt it was in everyone's best interests to do so in writing. The stake president has not responded. In a second case, a stake president telephoned during the first week in November and left word with the wife of a Sunstone Symposium participant, B, that he wanted to meet with B. B called the stake president back twice and left messages but did not pursue the matter further. The stake president also left messages again, but to this point, no meeting has occurred. In a third case, the stake president invited C to talk about her Sunstone presentation. In a series of meetings and telephone calls from the end of October to mid-December, he first presented himself as acting on his own initiative, but later conceded that he had received direction and that a transcript of the presentation existed. He pressed her to send a letter of apology to Sunstone. C declined. In May and June, both the bishop and the stake president initiated another series of calls requesting meetings. C declined to meet with either. In a fourth case, D's stake president contacted him in early December, expressed concern about D's support for church leaders. D was also a participant in Sunstone, and asked for a meeting. D wrote a letter expressing no interest in a meeting and stating that he had done nothing in his ward or stake to cause such concerns. During a follow-up phone call from the stake president, D repeated his preference for continuing any further discussions in writing and reiterated his belief that he had not done anything that legitimately fell within the stake president's area of concern. That conversation occurred in late December. In late March, the stake president again requested a meeting. D again declined, stating he had fully discussed the issues during the telephone call. An associate, E, of an interviewee, received a series of messages on his telephone recorder from his stake president. E spoke to him on the phone but said that he planned to consult an attorney before any meeting. No meeting has occurred. 22nd of February 1992, all 20 members of BYU's sociology faculty signed a three-page letter to President Rex Lee on 14th March, affirming their support of the church and of BYU, but protesting the ecclesiastical interrogations of some members about participating in scholarly symposia. Since a temple recommend is required, or temple recommend worthiness is required as a condition of employment at BYU, ecclesiastical action could affect academic standing and job security. 4 days later, the Daily Universe published an editorial claiming that Sunstone was not an academic forum. March 1992, an article on the history of the Relief Society appeared in the Ensign, quoting the Eliza R. Snow version of Joseph Smith's declaration, "I now turn the key to you," instead of the official George A. Smith version, "I now turn the key on your behalf." Elder Oaks quoted the Snow version in his April conference talk, but specified, "No priesthood keys were delivered to the Relief Society." 7th March 1992, a panel consisting of Lynn Knievel Whitesides, Margaret Merrill Toscano, and Martha Dickey Esplin presented a three-part invention, Finding Our Bodies, Hearts, and Voices, a response to Gordon B. Hinckley, at Sunstone East in Burbank, California, and at the Mormon Women's Forum meeting in April in Salt Lake City. All three women were subsequently called into meetings with their stake presidents and or bishops, at least one of them on the direct order of Lauren C. Dunn, church historian and area president. The meetings were usually cordial ones, but in two out of the three cases, there have been more than one meeting. 11th April 1992, the Salt Lake Tribune published an article about sections of the Relief Society exhibit at the Museum of Church History and Art that Elder Dunn ordered removed only hours before the show's opening on March 13th. The offending quotations included statements about the priestly role of women. 30th of April 1992, BYU and meanwhile, Phi Beta Kappa, the National Honor Society for Arts and Sciences, rejected BYU's application for a chapter. June 4, 1992, Eugene Kovalenko was tried by a high council court in Ventura, California, for apostasy. Part of the evidence against him was a transcription of a 1990 Sunstone presentation. During the question and answer period, Eugene had said, "We have the right to sustain or not sustain our leaders." 3 weeks later, he received a letter from his stake president announcing his excommunication. 27th June 1992, a Salt Lake Tribune article by Peggy Fletcher Stack reported ongoing intimidation of Mormon intellectuals, including hate mail received by Martha Sontag Bradley, BYU faculty member and newly chosen co-editor of Dialogue. That night, the Mormon Defense League, organized by Paul Toscano and Frederick Boros, held its first meeting. That brings us mostly up to date. I've omitted many incidents and barely mentioned many others that cry out for fuller exposition, but what's here is enough. And now, what can we do about it? I have 7 proposals. First, we must speak up. We must stop keeping bad secrets for an abusive church. We must share our stories and our pain. When we feel isolated, judged, and rejected, it is very easy to give up, to allow ourselves to become marginalized, and to accept that devaluation as accurate. If we silence ourselves or allow others to silence us, we will deny the validity of our experience, undermine the foundations of authenticity in our personal spirituality, and impoverish our collective life as a faith community. During the 1970s and 80s, I was an observer and occasionally a co-worker as a handful of modern women scholars discovered Mormon women's history. They did it from the documents. No living tradition had survived of the spiritual gifts and powers of women, of how they saw themselves, of their vision for women of the church and the world. By failing to perpetuate the past as a living tradition, the women and men who were its guardians had erased it. I cannot tell you how this hurt me. I learned for myself that silence and self-censorship are terrible wrongs. Reducing the diversity of voices in a community to a single official voice erases us. We must join in the ongoing dialogue between individual and community out of necessity and also out of love. Second, we must label what happens as accurately as we can. I pay my church the compliment of thinking that it espouses the ideals of justice and fairness. I am confused when leaders confiscate temple recommends, when members who publicly praise the church's actions. Blacklists, secret files, and intimidation violate my American sense of fair play and my legal expectation of due process. They violate the academic ideal that truth is best served by an open interchange, that disagreement can be both courteous and clarifying, and that differences are not automatically dangerous. Most importantly, I am dismayed when the organization that teaches me to honor the truth and to act with integrity violates those very principles in its behavior. I am bewildered and grieved when my church talks honorably from one script and acts ignobly from another. Some of the incidents I have mentioned have made me cry out with James, "My brethren, these things ought not so to be. I say they are wrong. I say they must change." Third, we must defend each other. Some official actions are obvious attempts to marginalize and punish intellectuals and feminists. Although some intellectuals and feminists are bitter, understandably so, others, those I know personally, are not trying to undermine the faith of others, do not hate the church, and are not cynical about their personal faith. To the extent that there is anti-intellectualism and anti-feminism in the church's response, it is unfair. Also unfair are any malice and irresponsibility in the activities of intellectuals and feminists. We need to sustain and support individuals who are experiencing ecclesiastical harassment. Such support will help prevent overreactions and speed the healing process in the survivor. Supportive observers may also help prevent some ecclesiastical abuse. I think it is wonderful that 14 people attended Eugene Kovalenko's trial as a support to him. Fourth, we must protest, and I also think that we need to give each other feedback. If I'm behaving in a crazy, irrational, unfair way, I need to hear it, and I can hear it best, probably not from my state president, but from people I respect and trust and who are close to me like you. Fourth, we must protect, expose, and work against an internal espionage system that creates and maintains secret files on members of the church. If there were some attempt to maintain a full and complete record, including the record of church service, the lives influenced for good, and the individual's spiritual strength, I might feel differently. I might also feel differently if individuals had access to their files. But they are secretly maintained and seem to be exclusively accusatory in their content. I find such an activity unworthy in every way of the Church of Jesus Christ. Fifth, we must be more proactive in dealing with our leaders based on our personal relationships with them. I have had good experiences with my stake president, but I am repelled by reports of puppet interviews where a stake president or bishop is ordered to interview and or punish a member on information secretly supplied by ecclesiastical superiors. Such a procedure does not uphold the ideal of confidentiality. Rather, it violates the trust that should exist between member and leader, and we should say so. Furthermore, the stake president, not the offended general authority, is required to deal with the offender. This process short-circuits the scriptural injunction of face-to-face confrontation, including rebuking betimes with sharpness and then showing forth afterwards an increase of love. And finally, such a system isolates and insulates leaders from members. They create hostile stereotypes of members who are evil and deserve to be punished and excluded. Similarly, members judge and stereotype faceless and voiceless general authorities who are known to them only through punitive intermediaries. Both behaviors are equally damaging. Sixth, we need to support, encourage, and sustain ecclesiastical leaders who also value honesty, integrity, and nurturing. Michael Quinn, stake president, is one example. In March 1992, David Knowlton moved a large audience at Sunstone in Washington, D.C. by describing how, after repeated abrasive encounters with his stake president, his bishop listened to him, asked him how he felt, and gave him a blessing. David said he could not stop weeping during that interview, which did much to heal his wounds. When Garth Jones in Anchorage, Alaska, used a Bible translation other than the King James Version in his Sunday school class, a visiting high counselor told the stake president, who told the bishop to release him. The bishop said he would fast and pray as he considered the stake president's advice. After doing so, he reported to the stake president that he felt his initial inspiration in calling Garth to that position was still valid and declined to release him. "This bishop is not a liberal man," observed Garth. "He's a righteous man." We need more such models of nurturing leaders. If you've had these kinds of experiences, please share them with me too. And seventh, as a community, we must seek humility as a prerequisite for a more loving, less fearful community. The Apostle Paul queried, "Am I therefore become your enemy because I tell you the truth?" Oliver Cromwell pleaded, "I beseech you in the bowels of Christ, think it possible you may be mistaken." These are questions we must ask ourselves, as well as posing them for others. My prayers for the church's ecclesiastical officers have never been more sincere than during the past few months, even when my sorrow and anguish have been most intense. I consider myself to be simultaneously a loyal Latter-day Saint, an intellectual, and a feminist. My identity involves all three elements. I cannot truncate my life by excising one or more elements in a misguided search for simplicity. In Nauvoo, at the first pilgrimage, Kathy Stokes changed my life forever by telling me, "When I went to the temple, I consecrated all of me. That included my blackness. If the Lord can use it, it's His." She set me on the road to realizing that the Lord wanted all of me, even the parts that the church did not want and could not use. With the utmost reverence, I declare that I have tried to make a full consecration. Consequently, as I hope for forgiveness, so must I offer it. And I do. We must mutually acknowledge our pain, whether intentionally or unintentionally inflicted. We must ask for and offer forgiveness. We must affirm the goals of charity, integrity, loyalty, and honesty that are foundational in the gospel. And someday, may we move beyond forgiveness of the humanness in our revealed religion to celebrate being a community knit together in joy and love. Thank you.
I appreciate the opportunity of appearing on this in this session, and I look forward to the book which Levina and Gary are preparing. I would just add, since the subject was mentioned, the Encyclopedia of Mormonism does, in two places, include Leonard Arrington. We've been, as church historian, we've been friends over the years, and I'm sure he and I, who have been one way or another privy to and in some cases party to some of the instances that Levina mentioned, are moved by what she has said and impressed by her bringing the work today, work together and courageously telling it. Mine is an interesting challenge. Levina's bill of particulars is comprehensive and disturbing. Her recommendations are significant, and her closing appeal is profoundly moving. I will comment later on her proposals, but first I will offer another set of recommendations, another alternate voice. A chronology of the troublesome interface between the two paths to knowledge prescribed in the Doctrine and Covenants, section 88, verse 118, study and faith, can be projected backward to the founding generation of the church. Difficulties have arisen and will continue to arise because the instruments of study, reason, research, and experience, and the instruments of faith, the law, the prophets, and the Spirit, do not always produce compatible products. And no universally accepted system of priorities guides the choices which may need to be made in such cases. I emphasize the phrase "may need to be made" because many past controversies have involved questions about history, science, metaphysics, cultural traditions, and other matters that have little or no bearing on individual righteousness or building the kingdom of God. Levina's catalog would be a lot shorter if both intellectuals and authoritarians were less insistent on defining right answers in such cases. In 1954, when I was about half as old as I am now, I was involved in a memorable episode that is already known to many of you. Having criticized a certain book in a public meeting, I was invited to meet with the author. The result was back-to-back sessions in which my wife and I met alone with Elder Joseph Fielding Smith and then President David O. McKay. They gave contradictory answers to the question, is the concept of evolution compatible with the gospel? But each said that he expressed a personal opinion. Indeed, Elder Smith described a conversation in which Henry Eyring wouldn't let him get a word in edgewise. The encounters left us with two impressions that have been strengthened by subsequent relations with other general authorities. They are not always in agreement, and they are less oracular in private conversation than in public discourse. In 1968, after my Iron Rod Liahona article appeared and reprints began to be distributed in some seminary and institute classes, I was invited to meet with my stake president. It did not occur to me that he might have been assigned to check on my testimony. Having language from the article later quoted in the conference address by the president of the church suggests the possibility. In any event, the conversation was amiable, and I remained a recommend-carrying member of a BYU Stake High Council. If the interview was by appointment, then the incident belongs in Levinas chronology, and it illustrates how the handling of the challenge of intellectualism has changed in the last generation. Two innovations are obvious, at least to me. One is a byproduct of the increasing emphasis on unity and obedience. None of our leaders will answer yes to the question, should all Latter-day Saints think alike about gospel-related subjects? Yet they are uncomfortable, some more than others, with differences of opinion, and the discomfort increases when the divergent views are publicly expressed. Unanimity being unattainable, even among the faithful, the suppression of dissonant voices is seen as protecting those members who find security in the formula, when the prophet speaks, the thinking has been done. The second change reflects the growth and bureaucratization of the church. Time constraints and managerial concerns require the brethren to delegate tasks to subordinates among the headquarters staff and the full-time and volunteer leaders in the field. This particularly complicates handling sensitive issues that impinge on intellectual free agency. In the spirit of Levinas' recommendations, I now address the church leadership dimension of the problem before directing most of my advice and counsel to the LDS intellectual community. I speak only to the policy of discouraging dissonance and some methods used to suppress it. I intend no criticism of either church doctrine or individual leaders. Certain tactics employed to discourage and suppress the expression of unauthorized ideas and constructive criticism are morally dubious. People under investigation or reproach are not confronted by their accusers, and sometimes they are inadequately informed of the grounds for being investigated or called to repent. Files of information, including untested allegations, are apparently maintained indefinitely. Bishops, stake presidents, and other line officers are sometimes given assignments that they do not understand or agree with, as several of Levinas' examples show. When they are asked to conceal the source of their assignment, they are doubly misused. When the inquiry, reproof, or disciplinary action originates with one of the brethren acting on his own or on a novel interpretation of an official assignment, the moral ambiguities proliferate. Enough of such actions have been reversed on appeal to show that no church calling exempts or insulates from errors of judgment. When the fair judgment of a dissonant sound, an alternate voice, requires that intent, context, and many other circumstances be taken into account, bureaucratic methods have severe limitations. Particularly questionable, in my view, are the cases in which temple recommends are recalled or jeopardized because of statements or other actions that have no conclusive relationship to temple worthiness. Having a recommend does not prove that one person is more virtuous, orthodox, or obedient than another. But it does demonstrate that church membership is important to the recommend holder. And it carries with it a right within the stated criteria of temple worthiness to enjoy the freedoms of inquiry, thought, and expression extolled in Levina's quotation from President Hinckley. Because the withdrawal of a recommend ordinarily implies that unworthiness has been established by confession or ecclesiastical due process, the use of the recommend as a coercive instrument is inappropriate. Moreover, the policy of inhibiting research, analysis, and expression, to the extent that it succeeds, deprives the church of a valuable resource. Many improvements in policies, programs, and even understandings have been responsive to ideas and activities born at the grassroots level. To discourage thoughtful and technically skilled Mormons from applying talents and curiosity to church-related subjects, except when they have church callings to do so, is to obstruct a conduit by which the oxygen of insight and inspiration flows to those who bear the responsibilities of institutional leadership. Furthermore, the policy of trying to discourage or suppress dissonant voices is, in my view, counterproductive. A church that encourages its adherents to seek knowledge by study and faith is unlikely to achieve homogeneity of thought or utterance. And repressive tactics simply elicit sympathy for, interest in, or hostility toward the targets of such measures. As the church grows and the leaven of the doctrine of free agency works among converts of many cultures, the number and variety of alternate voices is inevitably growing also. A recent request for permission to translate the Iron Rod Lyhon article for a Japanese publication is evidence. A second consequence of the anti-dissonance effort involves the understandable institutional concern about public image. When the misspelling of potato can generate headlines, anything that smacks of suppressing freedom of thought is bound to make news, particularly when individuals with solid professional and church credentials are involved. In summary, for both ethical and practical reasons, I stand with Levina in urging a thoughtful review of current institutional handling of alternate voices. When people are believed by those with pastoral responsibilities to be engaged in activities that threaten the well-being of themselves and others, pastoral counseling is not only appropriate, but mandated by church doctrine. But to the pursuit of knowledge, the exploration of ideas, and the exchange of findings in a non-confrontational manner, the case of Pelatiah Brown is still relevant. As the prophet Joseph said in 1843, quote, "I did not like the old man being called up for erring in doctrine. It looks too much like the Methodist, not like the Latter-day Saints. Methodists have creeds which a man must believe or be asked out of their church. I want the liberty of thinking and believing as I please. It feels so good not to be trammeled." End of the quotation. I turn now to the LDS intellectual community, to us, my friends. I will identify several components of that community, make a few specific observations and recommendations, and then conclude with advice to us all. The perspective derives from a long and fulfilling life as a meeting-attending, calling-accepting, testimony-bearing Mormon academic. It has persuaded me that we eggheads are partly responsible for the suspicion with which some Latter-day Saints, leaders and followers, look at us, and that we can and should do something about it. The academic, professional, and other intellectuals whose contributions to journals, symposia, mass media, colleges, and the church classes sometimes discourage church leadership have sorted themselves into three groups. One, those who more or less voluntarily qualify for temple recommends and at least occasionally use them. Two, those who are more or less involved in the programs of the church but voluntarily elect not to seek temple recommends. And then three, those who identify with and may know a lot about Latter-day Saint culture but play no part in the church program. We are also classifiable by self-perception and motivation. One, we see ourselves as constructive critics, seeking to influence the content and direction of institutional change. Two, we see ourselves as disinterested observers, seeking to understand and describe the church. Or three, we see ourselves as opponents of the church, seeking to undermine its influence and growth. We may see ourselves as disinterested observers while seeking and sharing knowledge about church-related subjects, and constructive critics while using that knowledge to influence institutional change. My perception is that most church-involved Mormon intellectuals see themselves in this double role. That some representatives of the institutional church do not share this perception is clear from Levina's paper. Finally, we are classifiable by the treatment we may expect from the institutional church and its leaders if our deportment is consistent with our status and intentions. One, if we are in fact hostile voices, we may and should expect to be opposed. This area of confrontation is outside the scope of this session. Two, if we are in fact disinterested persons with unsanctioned messages, we may expect a different institutional response if we are or have been Mormons than if our pedigrees are non-LDS. Individuals in the latter category are likely to be ignored or treated with respect. They may even be quoted in church publications. Latter-day Saints with this motivation, on the other hand, become suspect when they make dissonant sounds, and particularly when they become favorite media sources. In my opinion, it is very difficult for intellectuals with Mormon roots to be truly disinterested observers. A desire to defend the church or to legitimize criticism almost inevitably colors how observations and opinions are expressed. One sees it in Levina's paper and in this commentary. Three, if we are or aspire to be constructive critics, then our reception will depend in part on our not gratuitously offending those within the church, followers as well as leaders, whom we seek to influence. Since any critical analysis, however circumspect, implies imperfection somewhere, the present institutional leaning toward concepts of prophetic infallibility, scriptural inerrancy, and obligatory conformity makes the pathway hazardous even for the most well-meaning alternate voices. Christ's advice to his disciples is fitting. Be ye therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves. We validate our right to the exercise of freedom within the church by demonstrating that we value the church, the gospel, and the fellowship of the saints. We accept callings in primary and Aaronic priesthood, whose only drawback is that we'd rather be doing something else. We act like we care. Herein lies one of the great values of a temple recommend. Commenting last year on Jeff Burton's thoughtful paper, Developing a Church-Compatible Model for Life, I pointed out that almost all active Latter-day Saints do what he suggests. They adapt church doctrines and programs to their own needs, opinions, and lifestyles without becoming alienated from the church or from other Mormons. But I added, eligibility for a temple recommend being currently the trademark of good Mormons, you must decide how your remodeling plans bear on this fact. You will discover that this decision has far-reaching ramifications. Levina's cases illustrate one of these ramifications. Because of the presumptions associated with the temple recommend, dissonant sounds from recommend holders are especially perplexing, even threatening, to some church leaders. But those same presumptions make arbitrary treatment of such alternate voices especially troublesome, even counterproductive, for the reasons discussed earlier. Arbitrary action does occur, as it has in previous generations. But what Levina describes as the institutional commitment to ideals of justice and fairness increases the probability that her more egregious cases will be corrected in time if they have not been already. I am not suggesting that a recommend should be seen as an insurance policy, either for this life or the next. Indeed, my advice to anyone who now holds a recommend only because he has a job, only because his job requires it, is the same as my advice to anyone who would participate in Sunstone activities or write for Dialogue if her job did not forbid it. Look for a more acceptable job. What I am suggesting is that intellectuals who have meaningful ties with the church and aspire to combine the knowledge-seeking role of disinterested observer with the participatory role of constructive critic should consider the relevance of a temple recommend to their own lives. When I consider what the church has meant to me and my loved ones and how the gospel, as I understand it, puts these lives in eternal perspective, my recommend is worth its price. Furthermore, obtaining and using it confirms in my own conscience the right to be a constructive critic, an alternate voice. Now some specific advice on how to make your alternate voice more acceptable among church leaders, church members, followers, and leaders who are now skeptical, even hostile. I endorse Levina's 7 recommendations with these caveats. 1, the third, we must defend each other. This waves a red flag for me. We should not impulsively rally to each cry of persecution. The Kovalevsky excommunication, for example, is Kovalenko, I'm sorry, yes. Made it wrong on my typewriter and then read it. Kovalenko excommunication, about which I too know something, for example, is a weak foundation upon which to build a Mormon Dreyfus case. 2, the fifth, we must be more proactive in dealing with our leaders. This directs us to an insufficiently used option. The possibilities in this area are, I think, vastly greater and vastly more hopeful than some of us have been led to conclude. We spend, I think, too much time talking to each other, and our message reaches us beyond us through media accounts that understandably focus on the sensitive, the controversial, and the bizarre. Her last recommendations and conclusion lead directly into these closing suggestions. We should avoid giving the impression that we are obsessed with aspects of the church that are imperfect or that need changing. For the sake of our own mental health, as well as our public credibility, we should be aware of developments that show the dynamism, the competence, the diversity, and the Christian caring that abounds at the ward, stake, mission, and general church levels. I find a lot of encouragement in the Ensign, which I read as thoroughly as I read the alternate voices. It shows that even though the bureaucratic overreaction to Levina's pretty thoughtless mistake did not homogenize the editorial staff or the list of contributors, it also reminds me that people whose experience and temperament sustain relatively question-free testimonies find a lot of happiness and do a lot of good in and through the church. Next, we should avoid the dogmatism that we find offensive in some of those we criticize. Having doubts or questions about a church doctrine or policy is not the same as denying or rejecting it, nor does one inevitably lead to the other. Our academic mentors taught us that absence of proof does not constitute disproof. And our scriptures are full of reminders that we all see through a glass darkly. Our documents and our data may require that we question, even discard, some of the institutional myths cherished by some of our brothers and sisters, but they do not justify arrogance or intolerance. This leads to my final admonition. We should avoid giving the impression that we're smart alecks. Albert read at the opening session from the prospectus of Sunstone, which says, "We expect that everyone will approach all issues, no matter how difficult, with intelligence and goodwill." In my view, too much egghead discourse is deficient in the latter quality. Even where we're dealing with injustice and are moved to weep or to, at least under our breath, to swear, the communication should be reflect a disposition toward goodwill. We antagonize many who do not share our insights and perspectives by taking cheap shots for the sake of getting laughs. Mormons are a peculiar people, and our ability to laugh at ourselves is one of our collective strengths. But some of our humor is tinged with condescension, even malice. We make sport of sacred things and dutiful people. Church leaders neither desire nor deserve our awe, but they are entitled to our respect. Unless we manifest goodwill, we cannot expect that our right to speak will be acknowledged, or that what we say will be listened to. Encouraged by the Apostle Paul's observation, "A little leaven leaveneth the whole lump," let us respond to Levina's appeal for mutual repentance. Thus we may help to produce a Mormon chorus in which all of the singers hear the dissonant sounds of the alternate voices as polyphonic enrichment of the message of the music. Thank you.
We have just a few minutes for questions. In order to save time, if you have a question, if you would just stand up and ask the question, I will try to quickly repeat it in the microphone so that we can get it taped. Or you can use that. Go ahead.
My name is Eugene Kovalenko. Levina, I appreciate your comment. And Richard, I was shocked by your comment. I don't know that you know anything about my case, even though you believe you do. I'd like to talk to you afterwards. Levina invited me to be the first respondent, and I'd like to say I find myself in a situation, having now moved to Santa Fe, New Mexico, where I know no one in the LDS community, and I don't feel it appropriate to attend church, and have made a decision not to attend church as long as I'm not invited or unwelcome. But my community and my family has been, for all my life, Mormons. And I asked the question of Albert earlier about the possibility of learning who in the Sunstone community might be in Santa Fe or Albuquerque, and he declined because of official policy to reveal any names from Sunstone address lists, even though I understand that those lists are available for purchase by commercial institutions. So I find myself a sort of a man without a community or a country in that sense, and I wondered if there were anyone in here who might be able to help me resolve making some contact with people of like-mindedness or heart in our community, even though I'm not now official member of the church.
Okay, the question is, regardless of how we try to be very sensitive and bring up our concerns, we seem to still evoke misunderstanding and what have you.
let me say first a word with regard to the Kovalenko case. The very fact that there is fairly widespread difference of perception of the merits of this case is the basis for my suggesting this is not the case on which to hang the flag of intellectual freedom. There are several other cases in the list that it seems to me would, in terms, if we're trying to win friends and influence people and achieve justice, would be a better place to take on any kind of an undertaking of that type. Now, as to the what is being pointed out here is that some of the brethren at all levels of leadership, and I hope there's someday when some of the sisters have that said about them too, that they will make mistakes, they will do wicked things. It has happened before and it will happen again. Does our deporting ourselves in counterproductive or wicked ways contribute in any way to the amelioration of that situation? And since Christ has been mentioned as someone who got pushed around, although he was, as Latter-day Saints understand it, without blemish in his deportment, what was his advice? Forgive. It's a tough advice. But I think it applies not only to being celestially righteous, but if you want to win friends and influence people.
Do you want to quickly talk?
Oh, well, this person is coming up. I believe it's Jean England. I just wanted to say that if we are looking for the perfect intellectual martyr on which to base a policy of mutual support and self-defense, they've already won. None of us fits that category. None of us is perfect. None of us has been totally free of thoughtless mistakes. Richard said silly in his original, and looking back on it, how on earth could I possibly have thought that nobody would care if I gave Sunstone anything? But the church was very different that long ago. I think that we need to not look for the perfect case or the perfect martyr, but to work with each other as imperfect people in a community that's moving, I hope, in the direction of more perfect charity. And here's our expert on it.
It's been interesting to me that no one, Levine or Richard or anyone else, has mentioned what seems to me the chief danger to us, and that is the group that is compiling the files you talked about and seems to be behind most of the names being given to stake leaders, and that is the Committee to Strengthen Members. An ad hoc church group without general authority standing, but apparently great influence, headed by one William Nelson. And the Dreyfus case has been mentioned. I accuse that committee of undermining our church to the detriment of the general authorities and all of us. They are the ones who are compiling lists, compiling folders on people, sending names to people. And I'd like to know what we can do to stop this committee, to get rid of it. It seems to me that that's something that all of us could, with good conscience, engage in. If you're not frightened enough already, let me tell you that a group with a very similar name, the Congregation to Promote the Faith, was behind the Catholic Inquisition.
I will mention that a footnote to the first draft of this paper quotes Dostoevsky as relevant here. But it seems to me here is where the point, every one of us who has ways of approach, ways of making input directly to those who are in positions of authority, or for that matter to deal constructively with our state presidents and regional representatives, should do so that we're not subject to this until Gene gave it a nameless operation of a bureaucratic nature, which is lacks the leaven of whatever it takes to make for a really Christian outcome.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. Let me just remind you that tapes of this session will be available outside in the lobby for purchase. We appreciate your attendance. Let's give them once again a good hand.